Hey everyone, welcome back to the Deep Dive. You know, we talk a lot about emergency preparedness on this show, but today we're going to zero in on one specific piece of the puzzle that often gets overlooked. We're going to get granular and really examine how to ensure that when disaster strikes, those transit evacuation plans, you know the ones, actually work. And not just for some people, but for everyone, especially those folks who might be at higher risk or face some really tough challenges during an emergency.
You hit the nail on the head. We're diving deep into the work of June Kales today. She's a disability policy consultant, and her focus is really fascinating. She takes these, well, sometimes kind of vague ideas about assisting people with disabilities during emergencies, especially, you know, in the chaos of a transit evacuation, and turns them into, like, concrete strategies and tools that actually work on the ground.
Yeah. I love that. Turning the theoretical into the practical. So whether you're an advocate, a planner, someone involved in emergency management, whatever your role is, this deep dive, it's a chance to really get into the weeds and look for those weak spots in our current approaches to this stuff. How can we build stronger accountability, both, you know, at the organizational level and for individuals? We're going to break it all down, look at some fundamental building blocks, you know, those principles that can bring some much needed precision and clarity to this whole area of transit evacuation.
Right. And just to set the stage a bit, while a lot of the ideas we'll be talking about today apply, you know, broadly to emergency planning in general, our main focus is going to be squarely on the complexities of transit evacuation.
Got it. Now, look, let's be real here. We don't have all the answers,
yeah.
And we're not claiming to. What we want to do is to, you know, encourage everyone listening to take a more critical look at the way things are done now, to challenge some assumptions and hopefully spark some conversations that need to be happening.
You know, we can't ignore the reality of what's going on out there. There are unfortunately, a lot of transit-related emergencies. You know, some are isolated incidents, but others happen way too often. And our goal here, the big picture, is prevention.
I mean, think about some of the images that we've all seen. When planning goes wrong, the consequences can be really awful. I mean, remember those stories from Hurricane Katrina? You know, nursing home residents stranded in horrific conditions, people in wheelchairs trying to make their way through floodwaters. There were even instances of people being transported in, like, heavy construction equipment. And these aren't just isolated incidents, these stories. They highlight this huge need for better planning.
Absolutely. And there's this kind of magical thinking out there that we need to address. It's this idea that emergency registries are a, like, foolproof solution for evacuating people with disabilities. But the truth is, these registries, they just don't cut it as a functional piece of a real-time evacuation plan.
It's like that image, right, of those EvaCore helicopters swooping in to magically airlift everyone to safety. It's a nice thought, but it's dangerous to rely on that kind of thinking. You know, registries alone just don't translate into practical, on-the-ground evacuation solutions when things actually hit the fan.
So let's get into some of the realities of emergency planning as it stands. We've pulled a couple of statements here, anonymized, of course, taken directly from real local emergency plans. Okay, here's one. Neighbor-to-neighbor alert guidance should be considered for development. What are your thoughts on that?
Oh, wow. That should be considered phrase is a huge red flag for me. It's so weak, right? It doesn't say this guidance will be developed, who's responsible, or when we can expect to see it. It's just like a suggestion floating in the ether.
Exactly. And here's another one. When, where, have a personal emergency evacuation plan. What do you make of that?
It's so vague. I mean, the idea is good, sure, but it's missing any sort of specifics. Where should people have this plan? On their fridge, in their car, buried in the backyard. And, you know, what needs to be in this plan? What are the essentials? And crucially, how does someone get help if they can't evacuate on their own? Where do they even start?
And this lack of concrete detail, you're right, it's a recurring problem. In our review of, I don't know how many, countless emergency operation plans, annexes, you name it, SOPs, job aids, field operation guides, training materials, we consistently see this glaring gap. Detailed, actionable plans for safe and, importantly, accessible transportation evacuations. They're just often missing.
So it's like the plans exist, you know, way up high in theory. But when you get down to the nitty gritty, those actual steps needed on the ground, the specifics just vanish.
Exactly. What we find a lot is vague, aspirational language. We call them plan-to-plan terms. Think could, may, might, will consider, or my favorite, under development. And then there are these references to agreements or contracts that are so unclear. You know, no defined roles, no accountability, just a lot of hand-waving.
So the million-dollar question is why? Why are these essential details so often missing from these emergency plans? I mean, what are the reasons behind this?
Well, from talking to emergency managers and planners, several key factors seem to come up time and time again. One big concern is liability. You know, the fear of lawsuits if plans aren't followed exactly as written.
So the fear of not executing a plan perfectly actually prevents them from creating a detailed plan in the first place.
That's interesting. It's a real catch-22. They also talk a lot about the need for flexibility, you know, being able to adapt to the specific circumstances of an emergency. They argue that detailed plans would actually hinder that flexibility. But what we've seen in lawsuits, in real-world cases, is that when these agencies are challenged, they often can't even articulate a clear, consistent plan precisely because it wasn't documented. And that lack of documentation, it actually increases their liability.
It seems counterintuitive. You'd think having a well-documented plan would offer more legal protection, not less.
Right. Another thing that contributes to this is what happens during those tabletop exercises. There's this tendency to make assumptions, you know, about resources capabilities without really acknowledging the real-world limitations and challenges.
Oh, yeah. The old we'll figure it out when we get there mentality. Except they never really figure out the how beforehand.
Exactly. And I think there's a fear factor involved, too. You know, this reluctance to document details, maybe because they're worried about being held accountable if things go sideways, even if they were genuinely trying to do the right thing.
Yeah, that kind of environment would definitely make people hesitant to learn and improve.
No doubt. And then finally, this is a big one. There's this inconsistency in how basic terms are defined across different planning and response documents, I mean. So words like populations, geographic areas, individuals with disabilities, and even access and functional needs. They can all be interpreted and defined differently depending on which document you're looking at.
That's a recipe for disaster, literally. If different agencies are operating with different understandings of these basic concepts, how can we expect a coordinated and effective response?
So what can we do? What are some stronger standards we can push for? Well, first of all, we need to move past these vague good intentions and include specific statements that actually verify the existence of the capacity we need in our plans. Instead of saying, you know, transportation options will be considered, a stronger statement would be, we have current contracts in place with X number of accessible vehicles operated by Y company with the capacity to transport Z individuals.
Yeah, that level of concrete detail, that's what provides real clarity.
Right. We need to swap out that ambiguous language for actionable details. Details that directly answer those fundamental questions. Who, what, where, when, why, and how. And we need to implement a system of write it once and copy it or refer to it. Think of it like a master template, you know. So everyone involved in planning is using the same definition of, say, accessible vehicle. It eliminates confusion and ensures consistency across the board. And anytime you reference another document, include the link, the full name of the document, and the date of the last update.
Makes sense. It keeps everything accurate and avoids those contradictions that pop up when documents are being updated.
And for those under development statements, those are inevitable.
Hmm.
But they need to be accompanied by very clear accountability details. We're talking the specific department responsible, the exact position of the person in charge, and a realistic estimated completion date.
So instead of a new communication plan is under development, it should be the Office of Emergency Management, under the direction of the Public Information Officer, is developing a new communication plan with an anticipated completion date of specific date.
That's it. Much more transparent and trackable. And, you know, all of this requires a proactive mindset. We need to be strategic about reducing transit-related risks. No more ad hoc planning in the heat of the moment.
Absolutely. All right, let's switch gears a bit and talk about the response phase. What are some examples of weak messaging we often see, and what are the more effective alternatives?
Okay, so a weak message might say something like, neighbor-to-neighbor communication is important. A stronger message would go further and explain why it's so crucial, especially when you consider potential geographical limitations, communication infrastructure failures, power outages, all of that. You know, relying only on digital alerts might leave out individuals who don't have internet access, and door-to-door warnings might be impossible in geographically dispersed areas or areas with private roads.
So it's about painting a realistic picture, acknowledging those potential challenges.
Exactly. We need to acknowledge that there might be a significant period of yo-yo. You're on your own, at least initially. So instead of just a generic be prepared message, we should be fostering a wolue-u mindset. We are on our own.
WAO. I like that. It's definitely more direct and memorable.
Yeah, and it's honest. Messages need to be honest, upfront about potential limitations, and they need to empower individuals to take those proactive steps towards self-reliance. And we need to be upfront with the public about the response gap, that time lag between when someone needs help and when first responders can actually reach them. Even with the best local plans, a personal emergency evacuation plan is absolutely essential. Look, local emergency response resources are limited. They're rarely immediate in large-scale emergencies. Even just calling for help might be difficult if communication systems are overwhelmed.
So even with robust planning at the community level, individuals still need to be prepared to take care of themselves, at least initially.
Absolutely. And community-based organizations can play a vital role here. They can help individuals understand these realities and develop realistic personal transit evacuation plans with their existing support networks. You know, neighbors, friends, family, colleagues. These personalized plans, even if they're not perfect, can be life-saving.
It's all about being upfront and honest about the limitations of the official emergency response, not sugarcoating things.
Right. We need to manage expectations. Address any magical thinking about immediate rescue and emphasize that often the first people who can help are those nearby. Your neighbors, friends, family, not necessarily those official first responders.
So let's say someone calls for assistance with transit evacuation during an emergency. What specific information should they be given?
The first thing is to advise them to have a backup plan and explain why. Explain that the volume of requests might exceed the available resources, roads could be impassable, traffic could be a nightmare, communication systems might be down.
Setting those expectations up front is so important.
Absolutely. And then, when someone calls, those taking the information need to ask specific questions. Can the individual reach a designated pickup point? What are the exact dimensions and weight of their mobility device? Can it be disassembled? Are they able to transfer independently? What other essential equipment will they be bringing with them?
Those details are crucial for assessing the resources needed and figuring out if assistance is even possible.
Right. And they should be given clear information about the likelihood of a ride being available, a realistic estimate of the potential wait time, and a clear explanation of how they will receive updates, whether it's via phone call, text message, whatever.
So let's dive a little deeper into individual preparedness plans. You mentioned that standard advice often doesn't fully address the complexities faced by some individuals, particularly those with disabilities.
Yeah, that's right. You know that common message, get a kit, make a plan, stay informed. It's a good starting point. But it often doesn't cover the unique challenges that many individuals with disabilities face, particularly when it comes to getting out of a disaster area. They often need much more detailed guidance and support to create a truly actionable personal plan.
And this is another area where partnerships with community organizations can be incredibly valuable.
Absolutely. They can be amazing partners to contract with to help individuals develop these personalized emergency transit evacuation plans. The time, the expertise, the trust required to help individuals create truly detailed and effective plans, it's often underestimated and undervalued.
What are some of the key elements that go into creating these personalized plans?
Well, it's things like helping individuals sign up for local emergency alerts, addressing any denial or reluctance to plan for difficult scenarios, really thinking through the specifics of sheltering in place versus evacuating to different locations, planning for potential power outages and their impact on essential equipment, making sure essential equipment is properly labeled, and developing a comprehensive list of potential helpers with clear communication strategies. And that includes both digital and hard copy backups.
And it's so important to have critical documents readily accessible.
Yes. It's helping individuals gather and organize critical documents, both in physical and digital formats. Things like equipment lists with serial numbers, insurance information, medication lists with dosages, copies of prescriptions. They need to be able to grab those and go if they need to evacuate.
All right, let's talk about strengthening agreements with community organizations to enhance emergency preparedness and response.
So stronger agreements. They should leverage the existing trust and connections these organizations have within their communities to really amplify emergency preparedness messages. It's about multiplying our outreach efforts.
What are some specific deliverables we should be looking for in these contracts?
We need requirements for customized distribution of preparedness messages on a regular basis, quarterly, as well as before, during, and after emergencies targeted to diverse, high-risk, and often isolated communities. And the contract should clearly define those communities. Messages should be adapted to incorporate multiple languages and be culturally appropriate. And crucially, there needs to be continuous testing at least twice a year to evaluate the reach, accessibility, and understandability of those messages with a clear commitment to making adjustments based on the feedback received. So a system where message recipients can confirm receipt or answer a simple comprehension question, for example.
That feedback loop is so important to make sure the messages are actually getting through and being understood.
Absolutely. And the contract should specify the use of multiple accessible communication methods. Phone, text messaging, email, social media platforms, organizational websites, community trainings, and local meetings. Website accessibility is paramount, requiring the implementation, regular testing, and ongoing maintenance of features like properly captioned videos, detailed alternative text descriptions for all graphics, and fully accessible PDF documents. And of course, all of this should be done with specific reference to relevant web accessibility regulations. Any new educational materials developed should be provided in a range of accessible formats, including large print, Braille-ready versions, audio recordings, and digital files. And where appropriate, community partners could play a vital role in conducting proactive life safety or wellness checks.
So we've talked about the content of the agreements. What about the practical operational aspects? What specific tasks and expectations need to be spelled out?
Key operational details to include are clearly stated effective dates for the contract, the provision of at least 3 reliable 24/7 emergency contact points for the contractor, with multiple methods of communication available for each. The contract must also outline projected response times for delivering services and deliverables both before, during, and after an emergency, recognizing that these timelines will likely differ significantly from routine service levels. Service redundancy plans are essential to ensure continuity of operations from multiple geographically diverse locations. We need detailed payment terms and a clear breakdown of price differences for emergency versus routine services, including things like hourly rates and fees for expedited services. And it's critical to go beyond standard boilerplate assurances and include detailed specifications for compliance with the ADA and all other relevant disability civil rights laws, ensuring the contractors have a thorough understanding of their obligations. Finally, the agreement should stipulate their active participation in status briefings, coordination meetings, emergency drills, preparedness exercises, after-action reviews, and post-incident hot washes.
So, for those of you who might be involved in tabletop emergency exercises, what's a key takeaway from our discussion today?
Focus on those details. You know, the granular, often harsh realities on the ground. Avoid making those sweeping generalizations and untested assumptions. Remember, assume makes an, well, you know the saying.
It can make a mess of things.
Exactly. Mm. And we have to commit to a continuous cycle of improvement, whether you call it plan, do, check, act, or use the SWOT analysis framework: strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats. This iterative process is so important for learning from both our mistakes and our successes. Real progress comes from strengthening our processes, procedures, protocols, policies, and training programs consistently.
So lessons learned is more than just a phrase we throw around.
Right. Lessons are only truly learned when we actively plan, test, analyze the results, fix what needs fixing, document those changes, revise our plans and procedures, update our training, and then repeat that entire cycle over and over again. And we need to avoid those pitfalls we talked about. Vague plan-to-plan language, ambiguous underdevelopment statements without accountability, informal agreements, and using inconsistent descriptions for key elements.
And what should we be focusing on instead?
We need to be using planning frameworks and conventions that build in accountability at every step. Use specific, verifiable statements to confirm the capacity of our plans and resources. Swap out that vague language for concrete, implementable actions that clearly address the who, what, where, when, why, and how. Define specific, measurable tasks in those contracts with community partners. And when we do have to use underdevelopment statements, always pair them with clear accountability details. The responsible department, the individual in charge by their position, and a realistic estimated completion date. And then actually monitor the progress of those agreements. Finally, establish and use standardized, common descriptive statements throughout all of our planning documents that write it once and copy or refer to it approach.
You also mentioned some new resources that are available for our listeners.
Yes. If you go to the URL provided in the show notes and navigate to the useful info section, you find 2 new tools that can really help with this work. The first is called Transit Evacuation Plans for People with Disabilities. Key integration details. It's a practical tool for anyone involved in developing, implementing, maintaining, testing, and revising emergency transit evacuation services and plans. It can help you conduct realistic assessments of existing gaps, identify specific opportunities for improvement, track progress on key priorities, and clearly assign responsibility for action items. The second resource is Disability Emergency Personal Evacuation Transportation Planning. This one provides guidance and support for individuals who are developing their own personal preparedness plans for leaving a disaster area. You'll also find links to additional resources on public engagement strategies and a more in-depth explanation of why those traditional emergency registries aren't a viable solution for effective evacuation.
This has been a fantastic deep dive into a really important aspect of emergency preparedness. Thank you so much for sharing your insights with us.
My pleasure. It's been a great conversation.
And to everyone listening, thank you for joining us for this critical discussion. We've covered a lot of ground today, but the key message, I think, is pretty clear. Effective planning requires specificity, accountability, and a realistic understanding of the responsibilities at both the community and individual levels. Now, I want you to think about the emergency plans in your own world, in your community, your workplace, wherever. Are those plans truly actionable and equitable for everyone who might need help with transit evacuation? What's one specific, concrete step you can take today to move beyond those good intentions and towards real, meaningful preparedness? Think about it.